Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. YouTube, hello. Nikias, looking well-rested. Fresh off the PJ from Vegas, big sweet life of Nikias Duncan once again, baby. It's time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up. I don't know about the PJ part. I am sure about the rested part. Let me tell you, friends, I have no ad sponsorship. You know, people are listening. You know, chip in that money. But if you got blackout curtains, or if you don't have blackout curtains, get them. They are lifesavers. You will rest, buddy. Shout out to the blackout curtains in Vegas. That's dope. But I was in Vegas for in-season tournament things. A lot of fun. Colorful courts, some good basketball, et cetera. We'll talk about it. Happy to be here, though. We got a jam-packed slate for you, though. So let's talk some hoops. Let's get into some news items. First, on the W front, the WNBA draft lottery was yesterday, as we record on this Monday afternoon. The Indiana Fever had the top odds. They get the number one pick. There was some movement beyond that. 4-team lottery out of 12 teams. The Fever got the top pick. The Los Angeles Sparks jumping up to the number two spot, Phoenix Mercury third, and the Seattle Storm fourth. First and foremost, congratulations to the Fever. If Caitlin Clark comes out, it is expected by many that she would be the top pick in the draft, a very dynamic guard. If you haven't watched her play, you're on YouTube watching this. Go ahead and type her name into the chat. Watch those highlights. Watch her bomb away from three. Watch the passes. She is phenomenal. That's just the pick if she comes out for Indiana, right? They just kind of have to take Caitlin Clark there. Do you experiment at all with, hey, what can the number one pick get us?
No. If Caitlin Clark decides she wants to leave Iowa, then you select Caitlin Clark. End of story. Period. Without the T. Just period.
I appreciate the clarification. The one question that I did have about the Indiana Fever, I agree with you, first and foremost. Like, I think you just take Caitlin. Beyond that, though, they do have Erica Wheeler, solid guard, who, thanks to some contract incentives in the back half of last year, was the highest paid player in the W last year, so that's some fun trivia. But they do have her in tow. She was brought in to bring rim pressure, bring some veteran leadership. They also have Kelsey Mitchell, all-star caliber guard, finally made an all-star team last season. I do wonder, with bringing Caitlin Clark in, one, like, do you keep all three of those? Do you play Caitlin at three, have her defend three? She has the size to do it. And maybe you worry about her against quicker guards. Like, is that something that's tenable? Do you look to move one of Wheeler or Kelsey Mitchell to kind of clear just the one or the two spot for Indiana? And on the Kelsey Mitchell front, like, I do wonder with the Sparks as the two pick, they have an independent free agent, Nneka Ogumike, who was also an all-star and all W caliber player. She has been for quite a while. Is there an argument to be made for the Sparks to say, hey, this is a really good class up top. We also want to win now because our best player is in her prime and is somehow coming off of one of, if not her best seasons of her career. Here's two for Kelsey Mitchell. What do you say? Is that something that you consider if you're the Sparks?
I don't think I would if I'm the Sparks. Because here's the thing about this draft. If a whole lot of folks decide to come out, if you're one through four, you probably are going to do some high fives with each other. You're going to feel good about who you get. So I don't know if I'm the Sparks, if I would tap that button, just because you want to keep building towards the future. And I think an infusion of a young talent wouldn't hurt. As far as the Fever go, a lot of guards, but I would probably say, let's take this talent in Caitlin Clark and then let's build on it without necessarily changing everything. To where, hey, you have to do all of this. Because there is going to be an adjustment period. I think that's one of the things that we can all safely say. So I'd say, hey, let's try and make it easy a little bit. If we need to make that move and things go smoother than expected, we always can. But I think right off the bat, draft the talent, see where it goes, make the moves you need to afterwards. Find out the answer first before you just kind of guess.
Yeah. Okay, makes sense. Just wanted to get your thoughts on that. We will have more draft coverage as it actually gets closer. On the W side, but from there, let's go to the NBA news. Some less fun news. Mitch Robinson, as it was announced earlier today by Shams Charania, is going to have surgery on his ankle and is expected to be out 8 to 10 weeks. would be a figurative and literal big blow to the New York Knicks front court depth. Mitchell this year averaging 6.2 points, 10.3 rebounds, but a league-leading 5.3 offensive rebounds per game. The Knicks actually have an offensive rebound rate of 35.2 with Mitchell on the floor. That would be first, even a little bit higher than the Knicks' league-leading mark. So with him on the floor, it's even better. Also averaging a steal and a half and 1.3 blocks per game. Like, I've talked about it this year. Like, I feel like he's defended at an all-defense level. It just stinks. So first and foremost, I hope Mitchell Robinson has a speedy recovery and hope he's all right. In the short term, though, and something that we talked a little bit about pre-show, who do you insert into the starting lineup? Is it as easy as Isaiah Hartenstein? You are good. You are a backup center. We now put you with the starters to inject some more ball movement into that unit. Or do you do the other coach thing where it's like, okay, let's keep the bench intact. Let's go third string, player in a lower minute role. Do we see Jericho Sims, who to this point of the season, 9 games, 25 minutes played so far?
That was my biggest question. First off, it stinks. Mitchell Robinson's had a heck of a year. Obviously, you listed all the reasons why he's important for this Knicks team. The timing also not ideal for this Knicks team as they come off some games where Milwaukee and Boston said, hey, let's tap on the Knicks defense button. Milwaukee, you got to come up higher on the level. We're going to put two on the ball. Let's attack your weak side help. And then Boston was like, hey, you got to do the same, but we also have this big man who wants to take and make every shot against y'all. So good luck with that. Not the most fun circumstance. If I turn my coach brain on, the number one question I had was, do you start Hartenstein? I think last year, if you go back, the first time Mitchell Robinson was out, Isaiah Hartenstein got the opportunity. The second time, it was Jericho Sims. I probably think they go Sims here, mainly because you can kind of keep your defense intact to a degree. You can keep your first unit intact to a degree. The one thing about Jericho Sims, he's going to play with a lot of energy. He's going to screen. He's going to roll. He's going to give his best effort defensively. Rebounding not the same, but he's going to give you that. And that may work better, especially with how the first unit plays. You know, in my head, Isaiah Hartenstein could absolutely play with them. Do you want to use Hartenstein with that unit, especially the way they're playing right now, where Julius Randle's usage is high in different ways? He's going to operate with the ball in his hands. He's going to be in pick and roll. Jalen Brunson's obviously going to make his plays. RJ Barrett's more involved. They just figured out how to shift Dante DiVincenzo into the starting lineup because that fourth person kind of has to be, we need you to take and make shots, drive a closeout, defend. That's it. So I think in my head, I probably go Sims there. And the second part is you don't want to break up your second unit, especially with how different the second unit plays from the first unit. Like, that's one of the things that I was thinking about over the weekend. Hey, that Quentin Grimes-Dante swap makes sense because at a base, Quentin Grimes is going to feel more involved with that second unit. There's more opportunities for handoffs. There's more movement, more drive and kick. Probably have more impact defensively with that unit alongside Josh Hart. So for me, it's like, do you want to now flip the second unit? And now what are you running? Is it just going to be a lot of pick and roll? Because Jericho Sims is different than Isaiah Hartenstein. So that's kind of where my brain goes. I probably go Sims.
Okay. No, I think that makes sense. If you are just, you need, hey, you clean up things on the offensive glass, you screen, you dive. The closest player on the roster to Mitchell Robinson is Jericho Sims. So if you want to keep that kind of synergy, that makes sense. To the Hartenstein point, look this up a little bit earlier. He has played 26 minutes with Jalen Brunson, RJ Barrett, and Julius Randle on the floor this year. It is just not, there's not been a lot of overlap in the center room with the starting unit versus the second unit. So if you do, again, want to keep that intact, it probably makes more sense to go Jericho Sims there, let Isaiah Hartenstein do some things. The other thing I want to mention that I'm going to be keeping an eye on the Knicks front is that with the Robinson injury, as much as it stinks, it kind of serves as an opportunity for the Knicks to answer some questions or to force them to do some things that at least I have some questions about. Like, you've talked about their defensive versatility. I think if the center room is now Isaiah Hartenstein, which the Knicks have, you know, through his Knicks stint, has shown a level of comfort. All right, let's put you at the level. Let's just put you at the level, or let's just trap with you and see if we get the back line going. With Jericho Sims, if you want to go back to like some preseason film where they played him at the four sometimes, but like there's a level of switchability with him that you may not have had with Mitchell Robinson or Isaiah Hartenstein. Does this force the Knicks to tap into more scheme versatility and force them to do different things to see where they are? Because as we look you know, longer term, this Knicks team, barring catastrophe, I think they're going to be a playoff team. I don't think they're going to be in the play-in. I think they're going to be a playoff team. And I think they need to be able to solve, okay, what else can we do outside of Mitchell Robinson in a drop slash at the level of dropping back? And so this could serve as an opportunity to get some pretty valuable reps to see what else they can do. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I think the bigger thing with the Knicks when it comes to the playoffs, how much scheme versatility do you truly have? Because even if, whether it's Sims, Hartenstein, what's the next step for them? Are you just going to trap? Are you going to put two on the ball? Are you going to be at the level and be flat? Are they going to switch? Because they're not. They're probably not going to go small. Like, I don't think Tibbs is going to tap that button to a degree and say, hey, Julius, you be the five. Let's put some more wings out there. We can switch everything. I don't think we're getting there. I think for me, that's where the question marks from those two games kind of stand out to where, okay, if you're going to be more aggressive and not just being a drop, your weak side defense has to be very good. You got to be able to be in and show help and rotate out of it. Can they work on that portion? Is that the win for them? To where, hey, when Mitch comes back, we have this drop, but we can also get to the level, rotate behind it, take away roles, and play out of that. Ultimately, does that give them enough juice, though? When you look at the Eastern Conference and you look at some of the teams that they may face. And so, obviously, we talk about Boston, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, what do you do with Maxey in pick and roll or handoffs? Indiana, what do you do with Tyrese Halliburton? Now, we know what they would do against Cleveland. And that is the one thing they did show is where, hey, we're not afraid to put two on the ball against these folks. We also might make you prove it. You know, hey, Donovan Mitchell, you take this. Darius Garland, you got all this space. We're staying at home or we're helping off these people. So now it becomes like a matchup game to a degree. Because yeah, we could talk about let's play up versatility. Let's say Orlando keeps this going and the Knicks face Orlando. Does Orlando get the wake-up call that Cleveland got last year? So that's where my mind goes.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And then just very quickly on the switching point, only two teams in the league switch at a lower rate against pick and rolls than the New York Knicks do. That's the San Antonio Spurs and Minnesota Timberwolves. So again, with the Jericho Sims units, like I'm curious to see how much they tap into there. And even going to your potential matchup against Orlando point, we've both talked about, hey, what does this look like against switches? And for a Knicks team that doesn't do a bunch of it, That could prove to be valuable for them. Because I don't know if you want to just feed them a bunch of drops and say, all right, we dare you to chew up the space with the way that some of those guys can drive. Like, it's a fair bet on paper, but like something that could burn them. So I'm curious to see what that's going to look like. But again, we hope Mitchell Robinson gets better. Let's get to some trade chatter. Let's get into a little bit of trade talk.
Hey, call me boring again, user 887. What's good? About to chat it up.
We got eyes in the chat. But no, Sean Charania dropping another inside pass for the Athletic. So some names tossed out there. Pascal Siakam, OG Anunoby with the Toronto Raptors, as this is what, the 15th year in a row that everyone else in the league is looking to see what they're going to do with their roster, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, per Shams, the Hawks, the Kings, and the Pacers are the expected suitors for Pascal Siakam or OG Anunoby, but Siakam appears to be the likeliest of the two to be moved. So I guess of those three, I'll toss that one to you quickly, the Hawks, the Kings, the Pacers, what seems like the best fit to you for Pascal Siakam if they finally press that button?
Well, I was going to ask you a question before you threw it to me. Do you agree with moving Pascal before OG, considering both of them could just hit you with the deuces ooses next season?
I think if you are fully committed to handing Scotty Barnes the basketball or handing him the steering wheel, I think it makes more sense to keep OG around. If you have to keep one of them, I think it makes the most sense to keep OG around. He is the better defender. He's an all-world defender. He is the better shooter of the two. He just feels like a more natural off-ball fit next to Scotty Barnes than Pascal Siakam is, even though, in my opinion, like Pascal is the better player of all three of those guys. But I do think if you're just prioritizing Scotty Barnes and you're also looking at just the general age curve, OG's also younger, I think it makes sense to get whatever you can out of Pascal versus letting him walk. Also, it feels like the writing's just kind of been on the wall on that front, considering Pascal didn't get the extension heading into the season. So it makes sense to me that they would choose OG over Pascal, even though, again, I think Pascal is better. But, you know, prioritize the long term. That's where I go there.
I think of the teams, and back to the question, I didn't mean to duck and dodge, no bobbing and weaving here. I would probably say the Pacers make the most sense as far as like just fit and glove. We need an additional person with size to do things on the ball, to defend, to score. I think that's probably the number one for me. Now, I'm so bad with trade rumors because, you know, you got to do all the math and everything to put things up. And it's like that part you kind of sometimes can forget about. But I think Indiana is probably number one for me. If you add Pascal to what you've built, you already have a system. And so he's just going to elevate that team to a degree with the way they play with pace, the movement. We've seen him use on ball and off ball. He's grown to a degree. I think that would be number one. If I had to go number two, based on that reasoning, you would think I would say Sacramento. I don't love the Sacramento fit, to be honest, just with the way they play. It would work, and I would dig deeper, but just as a first thought, I'm like, do they need Pascal? Like, they kind of have a specific thing. I don't know. I'm on the fence there. Atlanta, I'm not... Not so much. It doesn't move me.
It doesn't move me. Like, I think with Atlanta, and I'm going to get back to the Indiana portion. I think with Atlanta, considering how they've been playing defense this year, where they've just been more aggressive with their fives and they've been super aggressive with their fours. I think if you are inserting Pascal Siakam into the spot of Sadiq Bey or Jalen Johnson, whenever he comes back, please get well soon, King. You were killing it. That makes a lot more sense defensively for a Hawks team that just has not been able to get stops this year. But then we go back to the offense where you get Quinn Snyder in there and him and everyone else on the rosters is echoing, Quinn wants us to shoot more threes. Quinn wants us to shoot more threes. Quinn wants us to shoot more threes. I don't know if mid-post creator Pascal Siakam fits into that ethos. In addition to, is Trey and Pascal operating off of each other? They're both really good players. That would just be an interesting fit between those two, especially if you're also keeping DeJounte in the deal somehow. And like, I think about what the Pascal and Fred VanVleet partnership has looked like the last couple of years, where it's a whole lot of inverted pick and roll and go screens between those two. Is Trey going to tap into that? And if it's DeJounte, who I think would be more willing to fill that kind of late game role, does a go screen from DeJounte really do anything to a defense in the way that a true movement shooter would? Like, that just feels like a lot to try to sort out. Like, maybe it's something that you revisit in the offseason for like a sign and trade, and you try to reconfigure things, then you have a whole offseason to really get the spacing right and everything like that. But midseason, I don't really see it for Atlanta.
You know, it's interesting that the mention was, hey, you know, the Hawks were pretty close to getting Pascal last summer. Here was the package they threw. And I'm like, well, you know what? If it's just going to be DeAndre Hunter, why not?
Get the talent in the room and figure it out.
Because at a base, you talked about Fred VanVleet and Siakam. Trae Young screening for Siakam late in games doesn't seem fun to deal with. I'll put it that way. And that way, at least you have more talent in the room. You have a quote-unquote big three. It could be... No disrespect, Bulls fan. It could be like Chicago adjacent, where, hey, we have the ability to get these players. Oh, what does this look like with these players?
What are we doing with these players? Yeah, so like Atlanta, I think if that was going to be done, that should have been done this past offseason, or you can revisit that in the summer and go sign a trade route and go there. With Indiana, I do love the fit. And as you were talking about not wanting to figure out the numbers because of how annoying that can be, I was like, all right, let me pull up the salary sheet for Indiana real quick, see what this looks like here. So, like, Pascal Siakam is like 37.8. So, we'll just say $38 million for this exercise. So, you got Buddy at 19, TJ McConnell at almost 9. So, we're looking at 27, 28. Benedict Mathurin will get you like 34. So, like, those three and another piece, Jordan Morris, $3 million, if you want to throw that in there. Like, that's probably enough to get you there. I would imagine.
Does that feel like a lot? Feel like a lot, though?
Like, in a vacuum, kind of, but like Buddy Hield, we talked about the trade rumblings before the season started. TJ McConnell has been linked to Phoenix for like 14 months. Like, Benedict Mathurin would be the one. Where it's like, do we want to give him up, especially in year two? But from there, it just kind of depends on, okay, how much do you believe the Wolves reports about Indiana being serious about trying to get a two-way star into the building?
Mm-hmm.
And how much do you believe in this superstar turn? Shout out JJ Redick. How much do you believe in this superstar turn for Tyrese Halliburton? And how early are, you know, how willing are you to push chips into the table? Because if you believe in him and you want to get another star in the building, do you believe Benedict Mathurin in year five will be as good as Pascal Siakam is right now? If your answer is no, it may not be too much for Indiana.
Here's where my brain goes. Let's say you do all that, and Pascal's like, this is cool, but I'm out. Like, I understand it. It makes sense. But, like, Buddy Hield is really important for that team. Like, I know he's been attached to all sorts of trade rumors, but his shooting ability, the movement that he has, his ability to screen on and off ball, that's really key. And, like, quiet as kept, TJ McConnell, that man just, hey.
That man's hooping.
Hey, man. Hey, pick and roll. Let me explore. 8-foot jumper. I got it. So I'm on the fence. It's tough right now because I feel like the league is open. And so for these teams, it's like, good idea. But we kind of like what we're doing over here right now.
Mm-hmm. I feel you. Like, I guess beyond that, is there another team that you feel like could make sense outside of those three?
You always throw me this question. I never know.
I feel like some of the SI folks, like I remember seeing something over the weekend. I don't want to miss a tribute, but someone from SI was like, hey, could Miami get in for either one of those Toronto guys? And I'm just like, talent-wise, sure. Fit-wise, I don't know if I like Pascal, Jimmy, and Bam together.
Really?
Like, that just feels like Southeast Toronto in terms of the spacing. And I don't know if you want to do that. If there's a coach that will make that work, it'll be Eric Spoelstra because he is insanely good at what he does. But like just conceptually, I don't what it may cost plus figuring out fit, that just feels like a lot. So I don't know about Miami.
Question for you, Golden State.
That's probably the one for what, I guess is the question. Because if you're just going pure salary plus young dudes, like, yeah, here's Chris Paul, like two of Kuminga, Moody, another young piece in pick capital. Sure. I mean, I think if you're Golden State, like you probably just do that. But I don't think Toronto does that. And, you know, we're not going to get into hot takes. Like, I don't think you do. Well, I don't think Golden State would do like Clay plus young piece. Even if Toronto play, yeah, we'll take this shooting for a year or throw some money on the back end so you can shoot around Scotty. But like, I don't think Golden State even considers pressing that button. No matter if you feel like they should look into it. But like, I don't think Golden State does it. I love the conceptual Pascal fit though. Like, I just don't know if Golden State has the assets to do it and or the assets they are willing to part with in order to do it.
Let me sneak one in the door on you. The Memphis Grizzlies.
Ooh. They do have a star creator coming back in a week or so. A big four of Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, Pascal Siakam, and Jaren Jackson Jr. would be a lot of fun. I guess my question from there just be like, who would be going out in that one?
Hey, Luke Kennard, come on down. Hey, yeah. Brandon.
They need shooting. I don't know if they need that.
Hey, Brandon Clark.
Like, you kind of just looking at the salaries, like, Kennard, Adams, Clark gets you to, what, around 38 or so? Like, salary-wise, they can do. Or if you put Marcus Smart in there instead of, like, Clark or Adams, like, that can get you there. Like, again, that I think that would just have to be, we got to throw in some picks to make Toronto consider that. But that would be an interesting top four. Like, I'm sure we'll be talking more about Pascal as we approach February, so we can put a pin in that one very quickly. Not much traction on the Zach LaVine front trade-wise. Per Shams, the Lakers and the Sixers are the expected suitors there. Over in Los Angeles, aside from the Lakers, PJ Tucker could potentially be on the move, has expressed some frustration about his lack of playing time. 5 straight DNPs for PJ Tucker. Kobe Brown getting some playing time, the young rookie, flying around defensively. He does have, he's making around $11 million this year. He does have a player option for over $11 million next year. So because of that player option, I would be surprised if PJ is willing to talk about buyout stuff. Like, I think if he didn't win the ring in Milwaukee, like, maybe that's more of a consideration if he just wants to play and just wants to win. But he also has the ring, so, like, cash in that money at the back end of your career is probably where you go with that. But if PJ is on the move, do you see any fits for him?
Hey, can, how do we get him back to Miami?
Get that old thing back?
How do we look, man? I understand why, but how do we get that man back there?
The salaries make it tough because with the way that Duncan Robinson has played, I don't think you're swapping out Duncan Robinson for PJ Tucker. No. Unless it is Duncan Robinson for PJ Tucker and something and a pick. And at that point, with what the Clippers just sent out to get James Harden in the room, like, I just don't think there's anything tenable there. The Heat have a $9.4 million trade exception from the Victor Oladipo deal. I would just have to check with, like, actual CBA people to see, like, how that portion of it works. I don't think you can combine, like, a salary plus a trade exception. That's been my understanding. I could just be wrong on that. So before I float something around that out there, let me check, fact checks. I don't want to be wrong on YouTube. But in the end, like, I don't really see Miami conceptually because of the salaries.
Can I be messy? What about Dallas?
Ooh. From the production company that brought you Grant Williams, here is a baby. Here's another switchable piece, a willing screener.
Hey, can I be messier?
What's up?
What about New Orleans?
Just the hashtag winners work. Videos for PJ. I can see the vision there. You know who I feel like is just going to press the button on PJ if it's actually a trade? This just feels like Pat Connaughton come on down. If he's not able to make shots when he comes back.
Okay.
They've already been playing a little bit of AJ Green. They've been giving some of the younger wings some playing time. They've mostly liked what they've gotten out of Malik Beasley in the guard room. So, like, you could... This just feels like, hey, PJ, we miss your toughness. We miss your leadership. You can also play some four for us. That's kind of where my eyes go. I'm with you, like, fit-wise. Like, I would like to see PJ back in Miami. But again, I just don't think they don't have the salary to make that work. PJ's at 11, Pat's at 9. They can throw in, like, Chris Livingston if they want to, or they can throw in Robin Lopez if they want to, or just insert minimum salary here and they can get to the $11 million mark rather easily. That feels like the one for me if something's going to happen.
Okay.
But we'll keep an eye on that. And then just very quickly before we move into some in-season tournament talk, again, Ja Morant is expected to be back December 19th against New Orleans. That would signify, I guess, the 26th game of the season for Memphis. Ja had the 25-game suspension. I have to go back through all of that stuff. But with Ja slated to come back, barring a setback, Bismack Biyombo, who the Grizzlies signed earlier this year, he was signed with an exemption because Ja was suspended. Once Ja's back, they will need to clear a roster spot and able to keep in order to keep Bismack Biyombo. So just keep an eye on a trade or someone being waived there. If you see some news pop out over the next week, that will be why. Because Bismack has been solid for Memphis. 6.7 boards over a block per game. 2 assists. They have been using him as an elbow hub. Hit or miss on the results, but they have been getting the usage there. He's been a solidifying force in that front court. So again, just keep your eyes on the transaction log. If you see why did the Grizzlies trade this guy for a second, or why did this guy get waived, that's probably going to be why. Preparing for the job return, and they want to keep this man. Let's get into the in-season tournament real quick. We did a little bit of a preview on the last episode. We got the title game, which did not count during doesn't count towards the regular season standings, doesn't count towards the stats. So it was fun watching my timeline as people were realizing, wait a minute, what do you mean this doesn't count? When this was announced, when everything was first announced with the NCAA. But anyway, it's fine. So that, I got some chuckles out of that. Also, I would just be very upset if I'm Anthony Davis and I just put up the first 40-20-5 game in a Laker uniform since Wilt Chamberlain, and it just doesn't go in the record book at all. But shout out to the Los Angeles Lakers. A 123-109 victory. Anthony Davis, again, 41-20-5, and also blocked 4 shots. And even beyond the 4 shots he blocked, challenged so many others, dissuaded Indiana from taking so many others because of his presence in the paint. It was truly one of the most dominant efforts I've seen from Anthony Davis. very fun to watch that. LeBron, who was the in-season tournament MVP, 24-11-4. Austin Reeves, we got the announcement. Funny enough, got the announcement as I was like walking to the arena. Shams did the videos like, hey, Austin Reeves ain't feeling too good, but he's going to try to play anyway. I was like, oh, man, caught a case of the Vegas. That's tough. 28 points off the bench for him, though. Tyrese Halliburton didn't feel like it, but 20 points and 11 assists for him. 20 points off the bench for Benedict Mathurin. 15 off the bench for Aaron Nesmith. A lot of bench production in the scoring total for Indiana. But any general takeaways from that game? Don't have to hang here too long.
Well, I mean, I got questions for you because you were actually there. But as far as the game goes, also, I want to say real quick, very funny. Again, the red court came back. That was hilarious. But I think the defensive gear that the Lakers showcased during this in-season tournament, if you go back to the Phoenix game and you look at where their help was when Kevin Durant caught the ball and how locked in they were against Devin Booker, when you go to this Indiana game and they basically said, hey, Tyrese Halliburton, welcome to these traps. We are putting two on the ball, and guess who's behind that on the back line? LeBron James. And you know where LeBron James is at the best defensively right now? On the weak side. No disrespect. Mm-hmm. No disrespect. Don't clip that. But yeah, man. Yeah. They basically said, hey, we're putting two on the ball. LeBron's going to rotate. We're going to trust we get the rotations behind it. And then on the other end, Marshawn Lynch. Over and over and over and over again. We are getting to the paint. However we need to, paint touches. We are going to score in the paint. We're going to put that pressure on you. And I think that's the one thing you have to remember about the Lakers just in general. Like, it just kind of unlocked in my brain. They're obviously a very – people love to talk about the Lakers. They love to talk about the Lakers. But I think they're a unique team in the sense that when their defense is right, they just feel different because they control the tempo in a way. Because we can – push when we have the opportunity, but if not, we'll just play our style, and it's not always going to be execution. And I know, like, especially on this pod, we love talking about the process, we love breaking down the X's and O's, but sometimes their ability to just, okay, here's a pick and roll, here's a post up, here's LeBron James, you have to worry about those things. And it's now all of a sudden, if they're scoring, getting to the line, you got to take the ball at the net, go against their set defense. It's tough when they're at their peak, I guess is what I'm trying to say, because they don't necessarily need X, Y, and Z to be right. They can hang around, and now all of a sudden, oh, no. wait, we're shooting 36% at the half? Mm-hmm. Like, I thought, in my heart of hearts, I was like, Indiana has not played well. This is not like the Pacers offense that we have seen all season long that you have proclaimed as what? What's the stat you'd be saying all the time?
They have the highest offensive rating in NBA history. And they still do, because this game didn't count. But they still do.
So we didn't see the full spectrum of the Pacers. They're only down by 5 at half, despite not making any shots. So it felt like, okay, we're good to go. They never got that run. The Lakers kept that pressure on them. And so I think that's where you're like, oh, they do have some size and length. Oh, they can protect the paint. They can push it on the other end. That was interesting. I thought it was a good test for the Pacers. I think all these matchups helped them.
Mm-hmm. And like, as I saw the rumblings about, like, or just timeline discussions, like, this was a championship game, but it wasn't a playoff game. Like, what does it mean? Can you actually get like a feel for playoff type atmospheres and game plans, et cetera? And it's like, no, but also was kind of my answer. Like, that's kind of the fun of the one-off for me, where it's like, okay, they can't just kind of gear up for this one. I think both the Lakers and the Pacers returned to action on Tuesday. So you had that game on Saturday to get a little bit of a break. So it was kind of like playoff adjacent, in which, okay, we don't have to just play our base regular season scheme and go from there. We can do some specific things. So as you mentioned, the traps against Tyrese Halliburton, it was also just the pickup points for him too. It's like, nah, we're not even going to let you jet up the court and get into your stuff early. We're going to bother you. And then when you try to run something, we're going to hit you with this trap. And like dealing with Cam Reddish, who, shout out to Cam Reddish, man. Like, we've had discussions about Cam Reddish throughout the history of this podcast. Where I was like, hey, here it is. He's doing the thing during that Eastern Conference Finals run in Atlanta. Then he goes to the Knicks, and I'm yelling at the Knicks, like, why would you trade for him and not clear out time? And then he was on the court, and it's like, well, this is the Cam Reddish that I was seeing. And I had questions about the LA thing. It's like, well, they just added all these wings and guards that can shoot now because of what the first half of their season was like last year. Cam ain't really shot like that. How much burn is he going to get? he has defended his tail off, and he's done a solid job of filling the gaps on the offensive end. So I wanted to give Cam Reddish his chops, I mean, his props there. And then even in the in-season tournament title game, he did his thing defending Tyrese Halliburton. The ball pressure was very good. The screen navigation was very good. And you factor in Anthony Davis coming up to the level or just flat out trapping Tyrese Halliburton from there, Tyrese didn't have a lot of fun. And so it was fun watching Indiana try to sort through counters. Like, okay, this is what they're doing when we go with our traditional middle pick and roll. How about we set these screens at half court? Okay, I got an opening this time. The Lakers have countered. Okay, let's flow into double draft with a guard screening first. Let's see if we can configure some stuff out there. Wait, let's just go with a pure guard pick and roll. Let's try to empty this wing or just space it out as far as we can. Let's see if Tyrese can get a one-on-one here. So like the Pacers did try different things, but the Lakers just did such a good job defensively on the perimeter, which, brief aside, it apparently helps when the Lakers have their full wing cast healthy. Like they could actually do some things that seems helpful for them, but it was fun watching the Lakers on the perimeter. And then again, Anthony Davis, even if you broke things down from the perimeter, here's just AD in the paint. Or if AD's at the level and you're trying to get into some of the short roll stuff, here's LeBron James rotating over and trying to take charges or blowing things up with a steal or a deflection. It was a lot of fun to watch that defense operate. And to your point, man, they just press the I'm bigger than you button offensively. And as you zoom out with like playoff projections with Indiana, like I think if they stay healthy, they're going to make the playoffs. I think they're that good. And the offense is historic right now. There is just a general size limitation with this group. Like as much as I've enjoyed Aaron Nesmith at the four, it is kind of an indictment that he's had to defend so much at the four because that's not his natural spot. And so the Lakers just tapping on that in addition to, you know, factoring foul trouble as well. But Miles Turner just did not have his best game defensively, if we can be frank and honest about it. So if the one bit of size that you do have is on the sidelines or it's just getting beat, you downsize. Like I like the Isaiah Jackson minutes, but ultimately like he's an athletic 6'9", dude, he's 6'9", or 6'8". Depending on where you're at, it just became overwhelming. And the Lakers just pounded them in the paint with drives. If the Pacers were able to miss, I mean, I feel like the Pacers, in terms of their effort level and stuff, I think they defended hard. They defended well. Like that was kind of the in-season tournament game thing that popped for me against Milwaukee, et cetera. Ball pressure was better. Pickup points were earlier. Rotations were a little bit more crisp than we've been accustomed to this season. But like at the end of the day, if you're small on the back line, you're small on the back line. And the Lakers just said, we're bigger than you. Offensive rebounds on top of that. Anthony Davis, just countless paint shots for him. The Pacers just didn't have an answer. I think it was a good test for him, for them. It was a good test for Tyrese Halliburton to see the kind of length that they had. Like, again, it's Cam Reddish at the point of attack. He comes off. Here comes Max Christie. He comes off. Here comes Jared Vanderbilt getting the matchup now. It's just like, not many teams can throw all of that at you. Like, even with the Boston matchup, they have a ton of really good perimeter defenders. Mm-hmm. How many super long and lengthy perimeter defenders does Boston have? Especially compared to like this Lakers group. Like, I think that part's different. And like the general airspace and the angles that Tyrese Halliburton likes to play with as a passer and as a driver, like those just weren't there to the same degree because of the length that the Lakers could throw out there. So very impressive defensive effort. That was kind of the big thing for me.
I got a question for you real quick.
Okay.
Well, one thing you mentioned, you talked about the playoff feel. Anthony Davis played 41 minutes. LeBron James played 35 minutes. They were mm-hmm. looking to get after it.
They wanted their money.
I think the pressure you mentioned was huge as far as just trying to dictate pace. With the Pacers' defense, it didn't feel like a massive indictment. It was also just a reminder, okay, the defense has to go up outside of sets or schemes. Like, okay, I think they're pretty solid at defending actions. The Lakers eventually just said, fine, we're going to make you switch and we're just going to keep driving. And now it's like, okay, we have to keep the ball in front. It felt like the pressure from the Pacers wasn't there. Like they were just kind of sitting back and the Lakers just had room to attack. And so that just kind of felt off there. Can I be respectfully messy for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
The Anthony Davis walking by Miles Turner on the red carpet video.
Yes. Like, that was a good bit.
Hey, man. You should have known.
Like, nah, dog. I'm here to get this dub. And boy, did he grab it. Also, just very quickly, as I was in the building. As it generally is in Vegas, like going back to like summer league stuff, very much a Lakers crowd. That was the case on Thursday. That was definitely the case on Saturday. And so you would see after every LeBron play, like the very early and one, you just kind of knew, oh, if anything good happens for this team, you're going to hear about it. So I don't know how much that affected Indiana. Again, like it was at T-Mobile Arena, so it wasn't at like Crypto or a big arena. So not sure how much, I don't know how much home court advantage the Lakers would have had there, but worth noting that it was like a crowd. I'm in the minority on colorful courts, period. So like you can take my opinion with a grain of salt. A lot of you already do anyway, so that's fine. Like I didn't mind the court. Like it, I guess it felt better than it did looking at it like on a Twitter picture or on TV. So I didn't mind it. I think a lot of people still are anti-red court. So, you know, that's fine. I will plant my flag over here. I think the court was solidly fine. But it was a cool atmosphere, though. It was a cool atmosphere. I was a little bit worried during Pacers-Bucks, as that was the super early game on Thursday. It didn't fill in until like midway through the first. I think people was just generally trying to get in and also just the time block. But once they got in, like I thought the crowd was solid. Again, it wasn't a playoff crowd. So don't want to gas it too much, but I did think it was solid. Like as in the third quarter when Damian Lillard and Tyrese Halliburton were having their back and forth with the shot making, like it got pretty loud in there. And it's like, okay, this is nice. They're starting to get into it. This is cool. This isn't the marquee game, but like you could see crowds getting into it. And so that part was neat. So I will say I enjoyed myself Thursday and Saturday in the arena.
It'll be interesting to see if they go back to Vegas. It'll be interesting to see what the attendance is like next year, because I think the biggest thing for the league was being able to land this type of moment. And now you kind of get the fear of missing out addition to it, to where now, okay, no, this is established. This is the thing. And so they just needed these games to be good for the most part. And the Lakers winning helps that. So I'm interested to see how they grow it, if they change the home markets, how that works. But the in-season tournament was a success. And I think the biggest thing that I can judge that on is the relentless amount of takes that I've seen about Zion Williamson and Tyrese Halliburton over the last 24 hours.
Yeah, if it wasn't a success, we wouldn't have those takes, or at least we wouldn't have those takes with the same amount of volume. Okay, very quickly to put a bow on in-season tournament talk, the all in-season tournament team was announced. Just one team, so yeah, no second or third, that kind of stinks, but whatever. Giannis Antetokounmpo averaged 29, 9, and 6 with two steals and a block. Anthony Davis, who averaged 23 and 15 with four assists, a steal, and three blocks. Kevin Durant, who was third in the tournament in scoring, 34.5 points per game, 7 boards, 7 assists. And his shooting splits are insane, if you want to check those out and have a nice chuckle on this Monday afternoon, or I guess Tuesday, whenever you watch this. Tyrese Halliburton averaged 27, 5, and 13, with only 2 turnovers per game, which is insane. And LeBron James, your in-season tournament MVP, 26, 8, and 8. Nearly 2 steals per game for LeBron, who is still doing it at this stage of his career. Absolutely insane. Some notable names that didn't make it. I imagine they just went with, hey, y'all are the guys that made it to, you know, the Thursday, Saturday portion. So no Jokic, who averaged a triple-double in 4 games. No Joel Embiid, who averaged 34, 12, and 6. No De'Aaron Fox, who averaged 35, 7, and 8. No Devin Booker, who averaged 28, 6, and 8. Damian Lillard, who had some halves during this tournament. But you zoom out, still shot over 50% from 3 in in-season tournament games and averaged 29, 5, and 7. So a lot of big performances, a lot of guys didn't make it. I guess if there was a second team, like maybe that's it. But just wanted to throw those names out there, toss out some quick hat tips. Any closing thoughts on the in-season tournament?
Nah. Salute. We good. 2 thumbs up. I think Jokic the only one who didn't advance that got a vote? I think I read that somewhere.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, fact check me. It's fine. But that's interesting.
Yeah, 2-2 record wasn't going to get it done. All right. And 2 teams that impressed. Steve, who's caught your eye? There's a weird like week just because we had in-season tournament things, so it feels like shorter samples. But any team that's caught your eye recently?
All the teams have caught my eye, Nikias. I have a question for you. I kind of just want to open it up debate-wise. Where are you at with Cleveland?
I feel like I'm in the same spot that I was at when we talked about him a couple weeks ago, where it's like, okay, I see it. I just want to see more of it before I have a firmer take. I will say, like, the Mitchell Garland stuff is feeling more weird than it did when we first talked about him, where it just seems very obvious that Darius Garland is a lot more comfortable when he is just a lone lead guard. And so I'm continuing to monitor that portion of it. But like the defense seems solid. And so I'm still in wait and see mode with Cleveland. Where are you?
I mean, I'm still giving them the benefit of the doubt. I think they have done enough positive things with their guard play. The shooting addition of Max Strus is going to pivot. So I still give them time. They're 7-3 on the road, but they're 6-6 at home.
Seems not good.
So that's where I'm like, hey, that's good. That not so much. I got a question for you on the Orlando Magic. Are we about to find out about them?
Probably, which quick shout out to Paolo, his 42 ball. That was nice. But yeah, we're going to find out some things because I have a quick thing on Mikhail when we get to the player shout outs. But like, buddy, he diced Orlando and he's really freaking good. So that's not red flag worthy, but like maybe a bright yellow, I guess. We're going to keep an eye on the defense as you alluded to, the schedule's going to get tougher. But yeah, I'm still in a pretty good place with Orlando.
Okay. Got a question for you. Ready for an unfair one?
Sure. What you got?
Who do you feel better about, Dallas or Denver right now?
I feel like the answer for me is like Denver by default because they got Jokic and they just won a title. And, you know, I think when healthy and when locked in, they're going to be really freaking good. So maybe that's just championship bias. So Denver, but that's a fair question. It is a nasty one because Denver's bench.
Yes. Yes. That's what we were waiting for right there, folks.
I'm trying, man, because like I like a lot of the young dudes. I understand that there was going to be a step back this year because they were going to give a lot of these young dudes some runway. Catch me in January.
Okay. How about that? Got another question for you.
What's up?
Who do you feel better about, the Clippers or the Rockets?
You know, it's the Clippers, man. Oh. It's the Clippers. I don't know if enough respect is being put on the names of the Clippers.
Wait, time out. Didn't you just disrespect Kawhi Leonard's name literally 7 days ago?
I didn't disrespect him at all. All I said it on the pod, and then I wrote an article. You can check it out on the Messenger. Is that, hey, these drives aren't hitting the same. He's not driving as much. The burst doesn't look the same. I want to know if this is just early maintenance for Kawhi or if this is a sign of Kawhi not being the same dude. I didn't know, but I was just noting this does look a little bit off. And so since then, naturally, like he's had the 40 ball and he's just been shooting the leather off the ball and has been very good defensively. So it looks like it's just early season maintenance. That appears to be the answer. That's all I wanted to know. that's what it was. But no, the Clippers have the offense continue to come around. It's being shaped more in James Harden's image. He's been super efficient. He's also been defending pretty hard. Just want to give him the quick hat tip there. Visa Zubats after a really cold start. Still monitoring him on short roll opportunities, but like the defense has been very good. He should get a little hat tip there. And in general, the Clippers defense has been good. So not to discount what the Rockets are still doing, but I do feel better about the Clippers right now.
Okay. I have another unfair one for you. That's going to be double unfair after your answer. Who do you feel better about, Brooklyn or Miami?
Ooh. Well, if I read the report right, I think Bam and Hero are back on Wednesday. Mm. So that would probably tilt it back to Miami for me. But buddy, if you haven't been able to grasp like the Bam Defensive Player of the Year case yet, watch the Miami game since he's been out. Just watch. Just watch. I'm sorry he's not averaging 3.5 blocks per game. Just watch what Miami's defense looks like and what they're trying to do without him on the floor. Just watch a condensed game on League Pass. Just check it out.
Now, are you ready for the unfair part?
Yeah, let's go.
Miami's next 5 games: at Charlotte, against Charlotte, 2 games against the Bulls, and against to Minnesota. Brooklyn's next 5 games: at Sacramento, at Phoenix, at Denver, at Golden State, at Utah.
Oh, well, you know what the funny part about that is, though? And this is just me putting my Heat hat back on. Like, Miami's going 3-2 at best during that stretch. Like, they're absolutely going to split against Charlotte. And that is just the Miami way. I've been watching that team for way too long. But yeah, that might get a little dicey for Brooklyn. But I mean, if the offense keeps humming like this and they just keep hitting threes, maybe it might not matter as much. And I guess I'll just get one of the quick player shout outs out the way. I will once again note Mikal Bridges is driving the heck out of the basketball and he's taking 30% of his shots at the rim after taking about 20% of them at the rim during the Brooklyn stretch last year post-trade. He's putting his head down. Short mid-range jumper starting to fall a little bit more. The man had 18 free throw attempts against Orlando, which was a career high. Mikal's looking good right now. He's looking good. He's looking good.
I have a nasty question to end it out.
Okay.
You can pick one of these teams that you believe in to stay at the top of the Western Conference.
Okay.
The Minnesota Timberwolves or the Oklahoma City Thunder. You can either pick pizza rolls or you can pick everything that Minnesota's been cooking.
Oh.
Yeah, bud. Yeah.
Oh. These are worse than the free throws. Yeah. I don't like this. Gosh darn it. If I have to pick one. Gosh darn. Because I don't think enough's being made of the fact that Minnesota's defending at like 07, 08 Celtics levels right now in the half court. Like that's they have been insane. I'm like, we just did this on the old man three things with JJ. I am going to stick with. I don't like what you did to me here. I will stick with OKC for now, with all of the respect in the world for Minnesota, which on a related note, I do have a player up there as in my player shout outs, but I will stick with OKC for now.
Okay. All right, I've caused enough havoc. What team did you want to shout out?
Okay, I just wanted to very quickly, as we get we're a little bit late in this with all the season tournament stuff or whatever, want to give a quick hat tip to the Chicago Bulls, who are currently without Zach LaVine. The who? We are giving some love to the Chicago. All right.
No, go back to the archives. No. You've been sick of the Chicago Bulls the last 3 years. You about to shout them out? No, you go. I'm going to go look up Kobe White and Patrick Williams' numbers real quick. And that's what we're going to do. Go ahead, big dog. I'm sorry. My apologies.
Is this what we own?
I didn't mean to do that.
Nah, you're fine. No, I just wanted to quickly shout out the Chicago Bulls. We're currently on a 4-game winning streak. So since November 30th, during that stretch, 10th in offense, 7th in defense. During the streak, Kobe White, you don't have to look up his stats, I'll give him to you. Averaged 24, 7, and 6. And he is shooting 52.6% from 3 on nearly 10 attempts. That is not going to hold over. That is not sustainable shooting. But he's looked so much more comfortable beyond the numbers. Snappier with the ball in his hands. The handle has continued to tighten over the last couple of years. That's something that popped last year as he looked better as a shot creator. But he's getting to his spots with a level of ease that he hasn't earlier in his career. The three-point shooting has been phenomenal. He's been more decisive with the ball in his hands. The passing has gotten better, continues to compete defensively. Kobe White has been a lot of fun during this run. Beyond him, I do have Patrick Williams' thoughts, but Nikola Vucevic, as we've talked about how he's played this year in Chicago, we've discussed very quickly, very briefly, like the rumblings of him not liking his usage and wanting the ball in his hands more. During this 4-game winning streak, which has not included Zach LaVine, he's still out with the foot thing. He's expected to be out another 3 to 4 weeks. We'll throw that in there. But before this win streak started, so games played through November 29th, he was averaging a shade under 43 front court touches per game and 7.2 elbow touches per game. Front court touches, that was 7th in the league. Since the streak, that has gone up from 42.7 to 62, which is second in that stretch on the Jokic. And if you're taking that 62 number over the entire season, that would be first by a solid margin. And he's also up to 9.3 elbow touches. And so I cite that to note, very obviously, with no Zach LaVine, the touches have to go somewhere. And so Chicago has been playing through Nikola Vucevic a little bit more. But what that's done, I think, has taken some of the playmaking burden or early initiation off the table for both Kobe White and DeMar DeRozan. I feel like Chicago's been doing a better job of going side to side, and they've been doing that a little bit quicker. And so they'll toss it to Vooch. They'll go into delay action. he can pick whatever size he wants to go to. If Kobe White attacks first and has something, then cool. If he doesn't, it's swinging to the other side to DeMar DeRozan, and now him and Vooch can go into a two-man game, or they can dump it back to Vooch, and now they're getting to some split stuff with him. And that's opened up some cutting for Patrick Williams. It's opened up some cutting for Torrey Craig. It's been fun watching them kind of reorient things offensively and to see the ball popping the way that it is. They feel a little bit more decisive. It feels like after every miss, they are just starting with, all right, we're going to go empty side pick and roll, or we're going to go delay action and kind of flow out of there. It just feels better. They're not really reinventing the wheel. It's not some creative new offensive system, but it just feels better. And then defensively, they continue to turn teams over at a ridiculous amount. Alex Caruso continues to be a madman defensively. Patrick Williams has been solid. Andre Drummond trying his best. And if I go quickly back to the offensive side of the ball, they have been killing the offensive glass during this win streak. I have it in my notes, actually. An offensive rebound rate of 37.8 during this streak. And before the streak, that was at 26.6. Andre Drummond has been a madman on the offensive glass, as has Vooch. Patrick Williams, much maligned for his, his energy and effort on the glass on either end. He's been flying in for offensive rebounds. You know, Torrey Craig doesn't care about his body or anyone around him when he flies in for offensive rebounds. So it's been nice to see, even when the shots don't fall for them, they are crashing in for extra opportunities on top of that. And now you got to face the set defense. And so it's just been a nice run for Chicago. I will quickly note, and I'll toss this to you for slander. These four games against Milwaukee at home, against New Orleans at home, against Charlotte at home, and then on the road against San Antonio. So not exactly a murderer's row, but it also isn't just a cupcake run either. We will see what it looks like moving forward, but I just want to give them the hat tip, especially in light of how hard I've been on Chicago and how I felt about their general front office process. They are playing well right now. They have been an enjoyable watch during this run.
The biggest thing I would point out, the assist numbers during that four-game win streak. 32 assists against Milwaukee, 32 assists against New Orleans, 23 against Charlotte, but 27 at the Spurs. So they are moving the ball. They are moving their bodies. They are playing together. That is a big key. So who do I slander more, you or Zach LaVine right now?
Let's just say me. Okay. Well, Zach hurt. My feelings just might get hurt. I'll be over there. So if you got bars for me, that's fine.
I have no bars. It's fine. I made my joke. We're good.
Okay. That's what I had there. Also, just a very quick hat tip to, again, the Portland Trail Blazers, who are defending their tails off, punching above their head a little bit. They're doing the thing. I noted that on the last pod. We talked a little bit about Tumani Kamara, so I'm not going to hang there too long, but did want to give them a shot on the YouTube channel as well. So,
okay. Okay. So hold on. So you shouted out the Bulls. You shouted out the Blazers. Can we find the third team to make this a total just Nikias apology fest? Who was that? Who was that team? Who am I looking for? Nah. It's
not happening. Catch us next week. That's the Kaya stuff. But no, we'll leave it there. Team that's making me think, I'll just go very quickly. The Memphis Grizzlies, just because I feel like we haven't really talked about them. They've just very much been in the jaws out. They hurt. They signed a bunch of people. They won't have their real team for a month. Let's just leave them alone. I would just quickly like to note, like, it's kind of been fun. Fun's relative. Like, I'm just a sicko that'll watch anyone. But it's been kind of fun watching Desmond Bain, like, expand his offensive responsibilities. And we haven't seen, like, the efficiency dip that normally comes with that in a bad context. He's nearly doubled his pick and roll volume from last year. And does feel that decision-making from there has been solid. He obviously can shoot on platform, off movement. If you duck under him for whatever reason, or if you switch and leave too much of a gap, he is comfortable pulling up from deep. He will take super deep threes on top of all of that. So you really have to account for him pretty much when you cross half court, because he's not Steph. But like a step or two inside of half court, you kind of got to pick him up because he's willing to shoot from there. So like that's been cool. With Jaren Jackson Jr., again, I think it's been a very good defensive season for him. It hasn't been quite at the defensive player of the year level that it was last year. A lot of that is just how many holes he has to plug this year. In addition to, again, still some foul stuff that he's having to deal with. The block numbers are down. But I have generally felt good about Jaren's defense. Offensively, kind of stinks that three-point shooting has dipped once again. But again, a lot of that is just he's having to take some tougher shots. It's been encouraging for me, both in terms of volume and going through the film and looking at what the drives look like. I'm glad he's driving more. He's putting his head down more, career high in free throw attempts right now. And so just kind of quickly monitoring the top two guys, like there has been growth with both of those guys, even with Memphis, again, they're not a good team. They're 13th in the West right now. I think 5 games out of a play-in spot as we record. They have ground to make up. But I did just want to say, like, they've been on my mind, so I wanted to watch some Memphis games over the weekend. And so I want to just get reoriented with their top guys and some of the other role players that have popped up. We talked a little bit about Bismack Biyombo earlier. Santi Aldama has been letting that thing fly. Don't ask me about the defense, but he's been letting that thing fly offensively. So he's got a little bit more rope. I just wanted to put Memphis on the radar, especially since Ja, again, barring a setback, we hope there isn't one. I think he is back next week. And I think that game will be against the Pelicans on TNT. So that's pretty fun. That should be an interesting matchup if he does meet the requirements and he's back. So just some quick Memphis thoughts. And I just wonder, like, how quickly they could turn things around, if at all, with what they have on the roster right now.
Desmond Bane, a.k.a. Desmond Bane, making another leap yet again, should not be ignored. So I'm glad you brought them up. I think Jaren Jackson Jr. getting a higher share of offensive responsibility is good reps for him. I think the injuries really hurt. For me, I was high on Memphis going in. I was like, all right, you now have to play defense and you now have to move the ball. And both of those areas didn't really hit the same. Now, obviously, a whole lot of injuries that changed the entire dynamic of this team. So I've been joking, hey, we're about a week away from someone saying Memphis is a problem. And then here we are with Nekias making us think about the Grizzlies. The only thing for me, I wish the defense was a little bit stronger. And 1-9 at home. That's one that's going to stick yeah. you in the long run as you're trying to turn this around. You're 5 games out. You're 1-9 at home. That's tough to overcome.
Not the grindhouse. And yeah, just to the defense point, that's another thing that as I like just doing some basic research on like some of their numbers and stuff. Just like, yeah, the defense hasn't felt the same. And they had all the injuries. Obviously, it sucks that Marcus Smart in particular has been out. You thought him and Jaren together is going to be a whole lot of fun, etc. Even with all the injuries, the fact that Memphis is 10th in defense is pretty solid in light of everything. 10th in defense, 10th in half-court defense. It's the offense where you really feel, oh, we really don't have like a true break them down, get downhill type dude. Again, Desmond Bane's been more pick and rolls. He's been driving more, but like he doesn't draw the same amount of attention. And even when he draws the attention, it's because teams are helping off of the guys they don't care about shooting. So it's just not the same. And so that's going to be the big thing whenever Ja returns, whether that's next Tuesday or a little bit later if something happens. Just him being on the court is going to draw to, and him putting the amount of pressure on the rim that he generally does is going to open up things and open up closeout attacks and stuff at a level that they just haven't had this year. 28th in offense, they're 26th in half-court defense as of recorded. So, going to keep an eye on it, but you can see the rough outline of we still defend, we can't score, we're going to get our best scorer back. Let's see what this turns into. So, just wanted to quickly give a Memphis note. Did you have anyone?
Honestly, I have a question for you.
Okay.
I have a question for you. Because I already brought up Denver. Because that was probably the team I was thinking about. Because I'm trying to figure out, okay, it's not that they're not good. We know how good they are. Are they putting themselves in a tough spot in that 4-5-6 area? Is that path just going to be too much? That's probably my only Denver question at this point. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about Philadelphia? Is this it, or can they make another leap?
Can I reframe the question?
Yes.
Because you know how I received that question?
What?
When will Tobias Harris come back? It's kind of what that's felt like. Because he got off to a ridiculously hot start to the season. Quicker decisions. They were running more post-ups for him. Talked a little bit about some of the flex action they were running for him. At least I made a video breakdown about it. Shooting well and fine. How much better has he been than the Robert Covington, Nicholas Batum duo over the last like 2-3 weeks?
Mm.
And like, for me, that can't even be a question. Like, even if you still land on Tobias because of the gravity he has on the perimeter, et cetera. And even that part, it feels like it's a little bit underwhelming because he passes up some shots. Like, historically, that's been the case. It's been better his last couple of years in Philly to where he's just flinging from deep. And that's been a welcome addition to that offense. But like, even then, I shouldn't even have to ponder that question. in terms of impact. And the fact that I've even had to think about that is a little bit concerning. So I think the level for Philadelphia to get back to where they were like first month of the season is really going to be Tobias returning to form, in addition to Batum's playing well, Covington's playing well when he plays, and now Kelly Oubre's back, and you factor him in. You're already getting Embiid and Maxey playing well. So like, I think that's probably the big thing for me with Philly. Does Tobias Harris return to that form or even just like last year's level? If he gets back there and they continue to get these contributions from the role guys, I think they're going to be just fine. They're solidly a good team on both ends. But like, I think they need him to pop back in. Also, while we're on Philly, just a shout out to De'Anthony Melton, who's been very good this year. I just want to throw that, put that on the radar. He's been very good. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with Philly.
Nah, I think the Embiid Maxey chemistry is growing. They have a lot of defensive guys they can throw out there, size and length. I'm just trying to figure out, okay, what's the peak of that? Can you make another leap? Can you make a push? Are we talking one seed here? So it'll be interesting. That's all I was thinking about. What players you gonna shout out?
Before we get into the player shout outs, I guess I did have one more like team that made me think, but it's really like a player based thing. Just keeping an eye on Dennis Schroeder in Toronto, who I think he's firmly a good player. I think he has positive elements that he brings to this Toronto team. I think he is a good point of attack defender. I think he's a very good driver. The playmaking has popped in a way that I didn't even anticipate it popping in Toronto. Like, even if you just want to look purely at his assist to turnover ratio, like, that's just been much better than I thought. Spacing concerns are still there. And with some of the load that he's been asked to carry in the half court, that's led to some really wonky half court offense late for Toronto, for a team that really can't afford like decision making on top of the spacing questions that they have. And so for me, and this is more like following the conversation of a lot of the smart Toronto people that I follow and read, at what point, if at all, does Darko say, hey, how about we bring Dennis off the bench? Let's insert Gary Trent Jr. into the starting lineup. Let's put more spacing around our top two guys in Pascal and Scotty Barnes. In general, let's reorient some of these on-ball reps to Scotty and Pascal, who, again, Pascal is playing much better than he was earlier in the year. At what point does that decision get made? And then just very quickly on the numbers front, Dennis plus that big three of Pascal, Scotty Barnes, and OG Anunoby, a 111.4 offensive rating and a minus 2.2 net rating at 300 minutes per PVP stats. That offensive rating would be one of the worst in the league. The big three without Dennis, one, that's only been 24 minutes, which is why I'm asking the question, when do we see some kind of staggering or just a starting lineup change with that? Because we just haven't seen those three without him a lot. But in those minutes, a 124.4 offensive rating. That's pretty darn good. And in only 16 minutes that we've seen the big three plus Gary with Dennis on the bench, a 125 offensive rating. So super small sample there. When do we see the sample grow? It's not necessarily Dennis's fault, but like, this is part of the issue that I had with him, and to a much lesser degree, since we just haven't talked about him at all this year. Remember when the Jalen McDaniels signing was announced and we talked about him on the pod, and I was like, I like him as a player. This feels like one of the worst possible spots he could have gone to, because I don't think any of the things that he does is going to pop in this situation. And his numbers are bad, and he hasn't looked super comfortable in Toronto. So to a lesser extent, him too. But with Dennis, like, there are good things to him. I think he's being asked to do a little bit too much because of the spacing stuff. You need the ball in his hands to mitigate that, but it also takes it out of Pascal's hands. It takes it out of Scotty's hands. To a lesser degree, it takes it out of OG's hands. And it just leads to some weird stuff. So that's where my mind is just kind of churning on Toronto. Do we see something flip there at any point? But that's all I had. Did you have Toronto thoughts?
It's context with Toronto for me. I mean, even going back to when they played Charlotte, they wanted to use Scotty Barnes as a hub. Use him as a screener. Let's get a switch. Let's attack. Now, the problem is, hey, the defense is in. They're showing help. Now, it's a good problem to have. I will continue to remind you, folks. I know spacing is always a big talking point, but if your players are playing so well that a defense feels like we have to send extra help, you've done a good thing. But how much of that can you tap into if you don't have a size mismatch? And so you could open some things up if Scotty is, quote unquote, at the one being guarded by someone. But when you just put your one on Gary Trent Jr., and now do you still have the same switching issues? Do you still just play drop in the pick and roll and feel comfortable with it? Like, I feel like there's a context that's missing. And I feel like Dennis has done a good job. The only problem for Dennis is teams aren't going to come up to the level. So he's going to have to make X amount of shots to force a defense to change. And if the defense doesn't change, now you lose some of the juice that Jakob Poeltl has as a roller. And now, you know, if you give Pascal the ball or OG the ball, Sky the ball, and Dennis is off ball, well, we got a help point. It's just that
it's for just
Toronto
weird.
Right now. It's just a mix of this is positive, but this is still present. And so it's just, can they move in the right direction there?
I got you. Well, very quickly on the player shout out front before we head out of here. I already talked about James Harden averaging 18-9 in December. They're 3-0 in December, 19-8 over their last five games. They are blitzing teams in the minutes that Harden's on the floor. Things are trending up there. Rudy Gobert, 13.5 points per game, 12.4 rebounds, only 62% on twos. That's his lowest mark since the 2017-18 season. But he is playing with a level of like force on the interior that's been kind of welcoming like that. 2.5 blocks per game this year. That's fourth in the league. Five straight double-doubles. He's averaging 18-16 with 3.6 blocks to boot. Over his last five games, including back-to-back 20-rebound games, so that's been fun. And I made the point a little bit earlier, but he is anchoring the best defense in the NBA right now. With Rudy on the floor, the Wolves have a 105 defensive rating, tops in the league. Their overall number is 106.7, so stingier with Rudy on the floor, naturally. In the half court, overall for Minnesota, 87.6, which is nearly 10 points below league average. I cannot stress to you enough how insane that is for you to not only be the best defense in the league, but you are 10 points better than the average defense. That's not a split that we've seen in over a decade. It's wild. But with Rudy on the floor, drops from 87.6 to 86.1. So it's even stingier than that with him on the floor. He is back to DPOY levels. It's a tough case at the top, and I can't wait to get into our first like award episode, the award check-in that we normally do to really dig into the defensive player of the year field. But he should be among the top three names at minimum. He's been very good defensively. So I want to shout him out there. I already talked about Mikhail, so I'll just sprinkle in. He's averaging 28-7-4 over his last five games. Derek White, averaging 15-4-5 this year. He's averaging 23-4-5 over his last three games. He is shooting the leather off of the ball in addition to the screening work that he does, the secondary playmaking that he provides, all of the fun defensive things, screen navigation, the switching, the secondary rim protection that he can provide depending on where he is. If you care about advanced stats, he's 15th in APM. We'll throw that out there. But here's the big thing that shocked me as I was getting into some Derek White stuff. Boston has a plus 14.8 net rating with him on the floor. They have a minus 2.1 net rating with him off the floor, which that's wild enough on its own. But I think the natural thought there will be, well, yeah, he's playing a whole bunch of minutes with Jason Tatum. Jason Tatum's been really good. His on-off splits are wild too, et cetera, et cetera. With Derek White on the floor without Jason Tatum, plus 9 per 100 possessions. With Jason Tatum on the floor without Derek White, minus 6.8 net rating. There's more to dig into there, but it's not just Derek White riding the coattails of really good players. He has been very good and very valuable. And when he's also just knocking down threes at the clip that he is, there isn't anything you can do with this Boston team offensively. So I wanted to give him the shout out there. On the Portland front, Dwight Reith and also welcome back Anthony Simons. For Mr. Reith, watching him screen, he was my screen of the week. Check out the 342 newsletter. We're having fun there. But he's a fun dude to watch, dog. He just bounces around offensively. The screens are fun. He is firing up threes with reckless abandon. He's also knocking down a pretty solid clip of him. So that's been fun. Making some short roll reads. Like, he's showing some juice. He can take two or three dribbles without bobbling it and getting downhill. He's made some nice passes over the last week or so. He's a pretty quality rookie big. An older rookie, first year in the league, I think he's 27. But he's been productive in that front court. There's like a fun on-off number there, like per PvP stats, nearly plus 13 net rating with him on the floor and a minus 11 with him off the floor. I think a good bit of that is the fact that teams are shooting like 26% from three in his minutes. That's going to normalize, but it does kind of match like Portland feels better on both ends with him on the floor. Like he's doing just enough. The screening amplifies what the guards do. He's making enough shots to keep teams honest. Defensively, he's holding his own. It's been a lot of fun. And Anthony Simons, just the general value of having a guard that can draw two to the ball because they can knock down pull-ups at a ridiculous rate. It's just fun watching him hoop and kind of reorient what the backcourt rotation is, digging back into our the mailbag question that we got against Portland. So just wanted to quickly shout out Anthony. Last guy I had was Dante Exum, who started the last two games, averaging 14-6-7 over those two games, 14 assists to one turnover. The fun beyond that is that he's been kind of used as a utility player. Like, he's run ball screens. He's done traditional point guard stuff. He's also been like a legit handoff hub. He's also been a screener, a real screener, and a, hey, Luka says you're being guarded by a guy he wants to attack, so you come up here. Like, he's done that stuff too. He's been a fun connector, like going back to the Portland game when they were just trapping Luka all over the place, making a lot of nice reads there. And just in general, it's cool to see him back in the league. But he's been a solid bench piece for Dallas. So I just want to give him a shout out there. That will do it for me. Did you have player shout outs?
No, we're good. We can go to free throws.
Okay. I'll go to mine because I think you have more than I do. Better guard defender, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander or Nickeil Alexander-Walker?
It's within the family. I'm noticing a Shai Gilgeous-Alexander defender push that's going right now. I'm going to give it to Nah right now just because he kind of has to defend to play more. But we'll keep an eye on it.
Okay, fair enough. Better passer, Tyrese Haliburton or James Harden?
I see what you're trying to do there. James Harden.
Okay, fair enough. Better passer, James Harden or Chris Paul?
James Harden.
Okay, better passer, James Harden or Steve Nash?
James Harden.
Oh, okay. I like that. What shot do you trust more right now? A Jason Tatum floater or a Jason Tatum pull-up three?
Pull-up three.
Okay, are you sure? No, I'm just kidding. who misses the ball more? Russell Westbrook or Darius Garland?
Russ?
Okay, fair enough. Is there a defensive player of the year winner whose discourse would annoy you more than Rudy Gobert's?
The Rudy discourse would not annoy me. It's the people who did not talk about Rudy Gobert's season last year that are now magically reappearing this year that bothers me. That's it. Rudy's playing well. He's hooping. Salute. Where were y'all last year? Why were y'all not talking about things last year? Let's see. Can I come up with another name? Anthony Davis?
That was the only other one I was contemplating putting on my list. And I was like, nah, Rudy's gonna win out for him.
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander leads the league in steals at 2.8. I'm putting Shai on the list.
Oh. That would be a really fun. Shai becomes the first player since MJ to get MVP and defensive player of the year in the same year. That'd be a good bit. And then I have to circle back to the LeBron year that he didn't get DPOY, but that's neither here nor there. Steve, two more questions for you, and I'll toss it to you. Is Anthony Black the Rafer Austin to Markelle Fultz's Jameer Nelson?
Ooh. I'm going to go no. But Orlando has an interesting decision to make here soon. Because, buddy, you like what you're seeing from Paolo? You like what you're seeing from Franz? Guess what helps, buddy? Anthony Black doing his job. And that's not to say that Markelle Fultz does not do his job. But Markelle Fultz can do more things right now. So, hey, Markelle, mega play. Nah, Anthony, swing that thing. Go to the corner.
And if you are watching / listening to this and you are statistically inclined, if you want to check out the on-off numbers with Paolo and Markelle versus the inverse, have some fun with that one. Last question for you, Steve, as, again, we record on a Monday afternoon, which means we're going to miss the Monday night activities. Who is CM Punk signing with?
I think he's going to go Raw, man. Yeah. Chicago man, he's going to go Raw. Anyways, did Gabe Vincent regret his outfit choice once he saw the bottles in the locker room?
You know, you talk a lot about players understanding the assignment. I don't know if old Gabe understood what the assignment was. You could just feel oh, y'all serious. It's just kind of tough.
Oh, man. Question. Drake spotted wearing a USC sweatshirt. Thoughts?
That explains the defense.
All right. Nikai, so have you had more fun watching football or football this year?
The answer is no.
Okay.
Answer is freaking no, okay. Dog.
Would you rather sit in the middle seat on an airplane or have to watch Michael Gallup deliver the Jordan shrug on loop for the next week?
Oh, I'll take the loop with the loophole that I could also show it to the Eagles so they can get some darn pride. That'd be neat. How you get browbeat in your own building? And then it's like, nah, we good. Y'all gonna see we pop a win on Sunday. And then it's 6 points in the first half. And then, I'm not doing it. You have more free throws?
Nope. Mission accomplished.
That's okay. Thanks for listening to or watching the latest episode of the Dunker Spot. Are you doing the all right, dog? About to get the abbreviated outro. Let's see. Oh, I'm the Kais. He's Steve. You can find us on Twitter. I'll put the ads in the description, etc. Subscribe, Apple, Spotify. We here. Second episode of the week coming Wednesday or Thursday, maybe Friday. Who's to say? I gotta recover from what I've had to watch over the weekend. That's neat though. Dunker Spot Community on Twitter if you want to join. If you haven't subscribed to JJ Reddy's YouTube channel, please do that. You can watch us. There's a really cool Kristaps interview that JJ did. There's a lot of good content on the channel. Also taunting on the channel, apparently. So that part's neat as well. So if you want more of that, subscribe to the JJ Reddy YouTube channel. We're on the channel every Tuesday. Tuesdays for the Dunkers. Which is extra fun because the Eagles are on Monday Night Football. Next week, we'll see what happens against Seattle. Anyway, we'll catch y'all later in the week.
Man, look what Jake Ferguson did to y'all.